teeth on in artificial intelligence at the feet of Herbert Simon, where I was an undergraduate, we used IPL5. IPL5 was a predecessor to Lisp. IPL5 had the property that if you wrote a program that iterated too many times around a loop, it fell over because it ran out of memory. But I wasn't consing anything. I know, but the machine cons is too. So I never wrote an IPL5 program that ever completed because it always ran out of memory. So that leads me to the story about McCarthy, and then you'll see why we'll get to our next speaker. In the days when they were transferring from the 650, IBM 650, to this IBM 704, the 650 had 2,000 words of rotating magnetic drum memory, 2,000 words. And the 704, well, that was a big machine. And in the same time, one of the programmers on the project noticed that it was very difficult to allocate new cells. Remember, this was the days of hand-coded Fortran emulating the M language. In hand-coded Fortran, you would say, call subroutine allocate, then call subroutine replaca, then call subroutine replaca, and then pick up the value of the common variable. Ah, that's the new cell with your data in it. So this programmer had the brilliant idea of, why don't we just make a function and call it construct or cons? You pass two arguments, it comes back with the address. Ah, that's a clever idea. And then it thinks, so easy to allocate new structures now. What happens, Professor McCarthy, if you call cons too much? Oh my good man, you couldn't possibly call cons too much. This new machine has 32,000 new cells. And he went away scratching his head. And in fact, somebody else wrote the first garbage collector for Lisp. I was at Carnegie at the time. We never got a garbage collector working. I say we, because I wasn't working on it, but there was never one working in one of Alan Perlis's languages, unfortunately. The first one that I know was in Lisp. The problem hasn't gone away. We have a man who's on our side with memory management. He entitled his talk Memory Management. That's important. Remember the 1980 paper, Garbage Collection Considered Harmful. Don't do it. Address memory management. But we can't get away from garbage collection. So here's the guy, Mr. Garbage Collection, Richard Jones.
Well, thank you, John, for that introduction. I have to say I hate being called Mr. Garbage Collection. I've been called worse. So I guess that will do. I'm very grateful for this invitation. As John said, Lisp started nearly 50 years ago. In one of the first demonstrations of it, when John McCarthy was showing this to the sort of the great and the good, by which I assume it's the people who have money in their pockets to continue funding it, halfway through the demonstration of Lisp, and suddenly the teletype burst into life. Now, with my students, I have to tell them what a teletype is, but I look around this audience and I suspect that many of us will know what a teletype is. And it was all this stuff about garbage. And the audience thought he was a victim of a practical joke. But of course, as you can guess, he'd left the debugger turned on and the garbage collector was printing out all the statistics. Now, they might have thought the garbage collection was a joke then. You talk to some C programmers, well, not today, but 5 years ago, and they still thought it was a joke. But now garbage collection is not a joke, and indeed, a garbage collected language is run much of the world we're familiar with today. Much of the internet and the sites you're familiar with, iTunes maybe, wouldn't work without languages like Java and the garbage collector. So I'm going to talk about dynamic memory management. Mainly I'm going to talk about garbage collection. I will say a little bit about things that aren't garbage collected at the end of it, if I have time. I was wondering when I was asked to speak, I thought, what should I tell them about? So I looked back through some of your recent proceedings, and then I looked through some other proceedings on programming languages, and I thought that what would be best if I tell you some of the things that have attracted my attention over the past few years as being things that are interesting in this field. So I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to end with some speculation, some of which might be a bit wild. So here we go. Now, two things. First of all, I challenge people who've been working in this field for a long time to see how these new ideas they've seen before in earlier systems, maybe in Lisp systems as well. The second thing is just to make sure we're all on the same page I'm going to give a very quick introduction to basic GC algorithms on which everything else is based. And I do apologize if I tell you things that you already know about. So first of all, why garbage collect? Well, for us in this community, we know why we want garbage collection. It's because the language mandates that we have to do it. But I think that's a fairly defensive argument. I think there are much stronger ones. When I teach my students, I encourage them to write modular code with strong abstractions, loosely coupled modules, and so on. And if you're going to layer over that some kind of memory management, explicit memory managed system, it makes those modules very hard to reuse in different places. So I think a strong reason for using automatic memory management is this software engineering issue, and I think that's as strong as one as all the other ones that are maybe more obvious. So here are the basic algorithms, a quick outline. I'll use a metaphor of a garage. This is a garage full of rubbish. Now, there's a very simple algorithm for telling whether stuff is garbage or not. If it belongs to me, it's not garbage. If it belongs to my family, it is garbage and can go in the bin. That's not a universally accepted one. So here's lots of rubbish stuff. For instance, there are a couple of bikes in there. Now, as long as I've got a couple of bikes, I probably need a pump to pump the tyres up. You know, I can't throw away the pump unless I've thrown away the bikes as well. So that's the essence of the problem of garbage collection, how to tell when you can throw the pump away. So, first algorithm, reference counting. Very simple. We put a note on each object, and every time we add a reference to that object, we increase the value on that note, and every time we remove a reference, we decrement it, and when the reference goes to zero, we can throw away the object, because it's dead. Another well-known algorithm is mark sweep, and this is a tracing algorithm. So you start from some known places, some roots, and follow pointers, and every object you reach, you put a note on, unless it's already got one on. When you've finished, then you check all the objects for notes, and any object that hasn't got a note on it is garbage, sling it out. The trouble with that is it leaves the garage in a bit of a mess. You know there's lots of room in there, but you can't get your car in because there are sort of toys and things all over the front of the garage. So you can solve that by doing mark compact. Same idea. We follow references from some roots, putting notes on objects, and then we slide everything with a note in it to the back of the garage, and everything at the front of the garage can go in the skip because it's rubbish. You can throw it away. The final algorithm, the basic ones I mentioned, is copying garbage collection. Here, first of all, you need to build a new garage. You then take, following all the objects from these routes, you take things out of one garage and put them into the other. When you finish moving things into the new garage, you chuck a can of petrol into the old garage, followed by a match, and the same goes again. And that's the demonstration I've always wanted to do sort of for live, but real far. One day the university might let me. So those are highly effective, or reasonably effective algorithms. They're widely used in a variety of different forms today. One major advance on those basic algorithms was the idea of generational collection. This was based on the observation that most objects die young. We tend to measure time in terms of bytes allocated, and you find that it's very common for almost all objects to die before a megabyte or so of data, further data has been allocated. So the idea here is that we separate objects in the heap by their age, and we call these different regions generations, and we collect these different generations at different frequencies. The generation with all the young objects in, where we expect to get lots of space back, we collect very regularly. Anything that survives that, we can copy it out and put it into the older space, and we'll collect those generations much less frequently. Now, the catch here is if you're going to collect one region at a time, you've got to remember pointers that cross the regions, because they act as the roots, the starting points for collecting that region. Now, generation collection is very effective. I mean, I did a quick, totally unscientific experiment before I came here using Sun's basic Java system, and the difference in pause times was between 5 and 50-fold, depending on whether you were collecting a young generation or an old generation. So those are some of the the ideas of generational collection. It's, as I said, it's highly effective. It gives you pause time that's really acceptable for lots of interactive applications. It doesn't sort of, you don't have to stop for most of the time twiddling your fingers waiting for something to happen. And it reduces the overall cost of collection because those older objects, you leave them alone in the old generation to do whatever they're doing and don't trouble them so often. But it's not a universal panacea. If you're not having objects that are dying sufficiently fast, you're going to have to do lots of full collections. If your applications are writing lots of pointers that cross these boundaries, maybe that causes problems as well. And finally, and a problem for high-end server machines is that copying can be expensive, especially if the survival rate is high. You don't want to be copying a lot of stuff around. And that's the reason why some high-end systems try to avoid using generational DC. Some of them, not all of them, but some. So those are some of the basic algorithms. But here's a question that some people, I mean, the people who really don't like DC because they think it's for weak minds, like to put to us. They say, how well can you do your garbage collected languages, you know, Java, Lisp, and so on, they're so slow. So here's a little experiment, and it compares the performance of a variety of different implementations of garbage collectors with the standard malloc implementation that comes with Linux, WA's malloc. Now, in here, you ought to be able to see a red line going across the top of the bar chart at 100%. That's the time of the malloc implementation, and the other times are the times for the garbage collector. The way this works is we've instrumented these systems so they know exactly when it's safe to call malloc on an object. And there's a bit of magic in there, details in the paper. And as you can see, if you look at the purple bars, many of those purple bars are pretty close to the performance of the explicit allocator. So, what's the catch? Well, the catch is that we need a lot of heap space. So the purple bars are running in six times the absolute minimum heap space that these applications need to run. By absolute minimum, I do mean absolute minimum. It's practically allocate a word, do a collection. Allocate a word, do a collection. It's that kind of minimum. If we ease that restriction to, say, three times heap space, we still get quite good performance. And most of those blue bars, which are the three times the heap space, between 5 and 10% overhead you're paying. And I think that's a very good overhead for the safety that you're getting. So that's what I want to say about basic algorithms and something about performance. Let's move on now to look at garbage collection for high-performance systems. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to identify some of the issues that I think high-performance servers require and some of the solutions. Now, one interesting thing is, what is a high-performance server today? Tomorrow is going to be a device on your desktop. And indeed, the MacBook I'm using here is already a Core Duo, so it is a multiprocessor, effectively. And we're going to see more and more of those come onto the desktop. So these what were high-end server GC-style problems are very much going to become problems for many conventional systems. So I'm assuming that we've got something with a multiprocessor, many threads, lots of heaps. We want good everything, good throughput, good response time, and so on, but probably not hard real-time guarantees. And we've probably got some region in which we can allocate very fast, and another region which is probably managed by something like a non-moving collector, a marked sweep collector most of the time, but occasionally needs to be compacted. The real aim is to exploit parallel hardware as much as we can. So, what do we want to do? We certainly need to avoid bottlenecks. Whenever you're talking about parallelism, that's what you're about. Now, where do we get bottlenecks? Well, heap contention, when you're allocating, is clearly going to be a bottleneck. Likewise, if you're doing a mark sweep collection, you're walking over an object graph, so you've got contention for the mark stack. And another, and possibly the most difficult of these problems, is compaction. If you're going to compact objects, it means you're going to move them. If you're going to move objects, you've got to update all the pointers to those objects. and you really want those updates to happen in a way that's completely invisible to the user program, because you want very small pause times. So you've got to update all the references to a single object, in a sense, atomically. It's obviously important to use lock-free data structures wherever you can, and things like load balancing is critical. The general tactic is to over-partition work and do work sharing, and there are lots of opportunities in memory managers for doing this. Things like marking and scanning. There are things called car tables and remember sets, which record these pointers that cross generations that I mentioned about. They can be processed concurrently, and we'd like to do some compacting concurrently. Now, I used the word concurrent, and I didn't really say what that meant. It's probably worthwhile giving a bit of terminology. What you see here is a kind of a representation of four ways in which we might do garbage collection. The first way is clearly ineffective, because we've got two of these user program, and we use the term mutator, because as far as we're concerned, the user program is just some damn nuisance that changes the shape of the object graph in awkward ways for us. So you've got the user program running in parallel, and then we stop the world and do a garbage collection. Now that's clearly ineffective, particularly as you scale up the number of processes you've got. Another way to do it is to parallel collection. And here, again, we're running parallel mutators, but then when we stop the world, we use all the processes to run the collection, and so on. And that's what I call parallel collection. In contrast to concurrent collection, in which the collector can run at the same time as the user threads, although user threads might be able to be stopped very briefly. So it makes sense to distinguish the two. And ideally what we want is we want parallel collection and maybe concurrent collection as well. So we'd like to do all of those. So the first problem for any kind of parallel system is, how do we do concurrent allocation? You've got hundreds of threads, and they're all competing for the heap, because they want to allocate. Clearly, if they're all attacking the same free point which they want to move on, and they've got to do that atomically, because you don't want two threads thinking they both move it at the same time, that's going to be ineffective. Fortunately, there's a simple solution to that, which is to use what are called thread local heaps, or local allocation blocks. And in this way, we give each thread its own block of memory in which it can allocate data simply by moving a free pointer on. But that's about the fastest way you can allocate data, just bump a free pointer. Now, in this situation, there's still some contention, but the only contention is when you're going to the local allocation block manager asking for a new local allocation block. So this system worked quite well. There are some difficult issues, and the difficult issues are what you do about threads that are either excessively greedy or don't use space very much, because you need to balance out how large the blocks you're going to give them are. So I think concurrent allocation is fairly straightforward. We can tick that. Concurrent marking is an old problem and known to be tricky. At the risk of sort of giving some of you a history lesson, let's see the problem. So here we've got a bit of an object graph. So we do some marking, and the nodes are coloured black, have been marked. Now, suppose that while we're doing this marking, the user program, the mutator, comes along and changes the shape of the graph. Maybe it adds a pointer there, and maybe it removes a pointer there. What do we do about these objects on the bottom right? Those two of those objects are clearly still alive, but the collector hasn't seen them, hasn't marked them. Well, there are two solutions in the literature. Now, we could either say you've got to remember that node which I've just marked grey. That's the node to which I wrote a pointer, and that's called an incremental update write barrier, because we're doing a trapping when we're writing that pointer and saying we've got to do a little bit more work. So we're incrementally remembering the new shape of the graph. That's one solution. The other solution is to remember that target of a pointer that we just deleted. Remember, I deleted a pointer from that black object to the grey object at the top. And we could remember that one. Now, if we remember that one, then we would remember all those three objects at the bottom right of the screen. And that's called a snapshot at the beginning, right, Barry? The idea is that it records everything that was live at the start of the garbage collection phase and makes sure you don't lose track of any. Now, you might think that... Oh, God. Excellent development. You might wonder why would I be interested in the second, because it's clearly is more difficult space. It's holding on to more floating garbage than the incremental update. Well, the real reason is that for performance, we don't want to put any of these barriers onto operations on local variables, because it would make the whole system far too slow. We only want to put these barriers on writes from one heap object to another heap object. The problem for incremental update is that the user program can install new pointers into its stack behind the collector's back, and it can do that ad infinitum. So eventually, with incremental update, you have to stop the whole world and finish off your marking process. Now, that's not true for snapshot at the beginning, because for snapshot at the beginning, anything that was live at the beginning of the collection cycle remains live. And so although it collects accumulates more floating garbage in incremental update, it doesn't mean you have to have this final stop the world phase. And that's a reason that more and more modern high-performance systems are using snapshot algorithms rather than incremental update algorithms. I have to say, it confuses me why it's taken so long for this to be discovered, but I thought it was known many years ago, 10 years ago at least. Right, so we can mark concurrently, but we probably like to mark in parallel as well. So how can we take advantage of all our parallel hardware to do that? Now, one way to do it is to give each thread its own local mark stack and do some work stealing, say, between threads if one thread runs out of work. But a much nicer way, I think, is a system called Gray Packets, which was originally invented by Insignia Solutions. Here's the idea. We have a big pool of packets that have work to do. Now, it's called Gray Packets because the work that they're going to do is to mark those objects that were on the previous slide that were coloured grey. I mean, grey meaning I haven't finished with them, I need to do some more work on them. Each thread has two packets, a full one, which it's got from the grey packet manager, and an empty one. When it receives its full packet, it goes through the items in that packet and marks what they point to. If it gets new marking work to do, which it's likely to as it's walking over the graph, it puts this new work into an empty packet, which it holds. When it's finished with its full packet, it returns it as an empty packet to the packet manager and asks for a new one. When its empty packet is full, it returns that to the packet manager so that maybe some other thread can use it. Now, there are a number of nice advantages to this. First of all, it avoids most contention. The only contention is possibly for acquiring new packets, not for doing individual bits of marking. One of the very nice things about this, rather than a traditional mark stack algorithm, is you can do a lot of prefetching, because the one thing you know about the items in the packet is you're going to go through them one by one. And that means if you've got hardware that can do it, you can issue prefetch instructions that says, no, I know I'm going to we want that piece of data at that address in a short while. Processor, please go and fetch it and get it into the cache so that the point when I do want to use it is already in the cache and I don't have cache stores. And that works very nicely with this kind of gray packet mechanism when it doesn't work so nicely with stacks. And also, there are a number of processor weak ordering issues that this simplifies a lot, but I'm not going to go into that. So, we can allocate, we can mark concurrently, we can mark in parallel. What about compaction? Now, the big problem for large systems is that if we use a non-moving collector, which we might want to because we don't want the cost of copying things, eventually that heap is going to fragment. And we're going to have to do something to defragment it. There are a number of issues for compaction, such as how do we move the objects, and how do we update all the references, and we'd like to do that in parallel and concurrently. So here's the general strategy that's used by all of these systems, and you'll probably recognize it as basically an old Lisp idea. First of all, if you're going to do compaction, and you're going to do it efficiently, you're going to have to break the heap up into lots of regions and compact those one at a time. Maybe I really mean, if you've only got one thread doing the compaction, I really mean compact one region at a time. Or maybe if you've got multiple processors, each processor gets its own region to compact. So imagine we've got this heap and we go through the markers, go through and mark some objects. And let's suppose up this colored representation represents which objects are marked and which are free. As we're doing that marking, we can construct remembered sets. That is, we can remember where the objects that point into each of these regions actually are. And we can record those in a sides table called a remembered set. And we can then use those remembered sets to fix up references. Now we can choose which of those regions we want to compact. We might choose it by this amount of live data in them, or the number of references, or so on. So here we choose one, and then we can compact it in place. Now let's do this parallel. A very efficient mechanism in the IBM Java system is to decide, first of all, to break the heap up into a few large target areas. Number of target areas is approximately proportional to the number of processes you're running, so they're fairly large, and also a number of small blocks. Each processor gets to decide which region it's going to be compacting into and which region it's going to be compacting from, so there's a bit of contention to decide who gets which target, but we can do that with atomic instructions like compare and swap instructions. And then we can move, each processor can move objects from its target region into its destination target region. So maybe we move one slot from that one on the right hand side to the region on the left. Now we can either move objects individually one by one, or we can, at the cost of a little bit of space overhead, say, because these blocks that we're dealing with are quite small, we can just shove the whole block across, and so we don't have to move objects individually, we just move the whole, 256 byte block, maybe with a block move instruction. And we get good performance from this. They compared it with a standard stop the world system, and they found that the compaction time was reduced by about a factor of four. This was for a fairly large three-tier business system. They got even better performance, if they did it with blocks at the moment, block at a time. And the other good thing about this mechanism, it was pretty linear in the number of threads or the number of processes that they had. So that's one way of doing compaction. Now, here's another system that I'm sure many of you have seen before. When I was talking about marking, I said, let's record where the pointer writes, the mutator writes things, and make sure we intercept that. Another way to do it is make sure that the user program can never see any objects unless the collector has seen them first. And to do that, we use what's called a read barrier, or trap accesses to the data. We can either do that in software, or we can do it using memory protection mechanisms. So maybe if we want to access this object on that great page, that page that we haven't finished looking at, I use the word page loosely, but by the way, I don't necessarily mean an operating system page. When the mutator tries to read that object, we trap it using the hardware memory protection system and deal with the objects on that page. Whatever our garbage collection algorithm is, we make sure we finish with them before we let the mutator access it. So we can exploit this for a compacting collector. As usual with compaction, the first thing we could do is mark the whole of the heap and identify which objects we need to preserve. And then in this system, they have to stop the world briefly while they move objects. Now, moving objects is comparatively fast, because the one thing you know when you move, you can predict which object you're going to reach next, so you can take advantage of all kinds of prefetching mechanisms to get things into the cache. You've got fast operations for moving objects. What costs is updating all the addresses. So we move all the objects, and then we protect the whole of the heap, and then we allow the user programs to start again. Now, as the user programs are working, they're going to get access violations as they try to access pages that we've locked. And at that time, we can trap those, and we can do the updates to those pages as we go. Now, one thing, an obvious question to ask is, well, how can the collector get access to these things to update the addresses, but the user program gets trapped? Well, the answer is that we need to play games with the virtual memory mechanism and use two different virtual address spaces for the heap, two different virtual address revenues. We use the second one for fix-up. And this mechanism, again, it's very effective. It reduces compaction time to a small fraction of mark time, rather than being many times longer than mark time. Now, let's make things look even a bit more like systems that you might have seen before. A fairly new company is called Azul Systems, and they have this collection system called the Pauseless GC, which runs on their custom hardware. Azul Systems hardware have up to 24 cores per chip, and they can have up to 16 chips in one of their machines. They have a custom operating system with fast use mode trap handling, very large page units, each page is about a megabyte, and they also have a GC mode between user mode and kernel mode in their system. Other things you might know, they've also got tagged pointers, effectively, which is, again, something you might have heard of, come across tagged pointers in your distant memory. I mean, I kind of invite you to compare this with some of the lessons learned from the old symbolics machines and other list machines. So what do they do? They have three phases: mark, relocate, and remap. Marking is done in parallel and concurrently, using work lists. Threads mark their own routes. Block threads get marked by special marking threads. And then they relocate by protecting all the pages and moving them concurrently with the user program. They free physical memory immediately, but not virtual memory, so you might have some stale references about. And because they want to keep track of where they've moved something, they need to put forwarding pointers saying where an object has been moved to. They keep those in a side table rather than the objects themselves. After they've done the marking, they let the system go, and any mutator that tries to access an object on a page that's moved gets a trap, and the same kind of update and fix up as done before. They also have the GC threads running at the same time, which just walk over the object graph, deliberately tripping these access violations and updating the updating references. One thing to notice is that all of these three phases can operate concurrently, or at least the relocate and remap phase can operate concurrently with the next marking phase, not obviously the first marking phase. And they claim to get very good pause times. The only problem is, because their architecture is so different from any other architecture, it's kind of hard to do fair comparisons. But certainly they seem to get very good pause times. So I've talked about high-performance computing. Now, let's look at some other ideas that may be being thought of again. For a long time, many people, myself included, have dismissed reference counting as being hopelessly inefficient because of all the problems of cyclic data structures, of reference counting operations have to be atomic, so you wouldn't want two threads accessing the same object trying to change the reference counting at the same time. because you get all kinds of race conditions. So, but reference counting has seen a major rebirth in interest recently. So let's look at the solutions here. The first problem is cyclic reference counting. The problem is, if two objects refer to each other, then their reference counts are never going to go to zero, so they can never be reclaimed as a standard reference counter. The second point is, as I said, we don't want contention on reference count operations. So David Bacon's concurrent cycle collector attacks this in two ways. First of all, it uses a producer-consumer model for reference count operations. User threads produce reference count operations, and a separate collector thread consumes them. To make sure that there's no races between different threads, the collector divides the world up into epochs, and it always does the increment operations from the current epoch first, and then in the next epoch, it does the decrement operation. So you never get the problem where the decrement operation overtakes an increment operation, and you get something prematurely collected. It manages cycles by a technique called trial deletion. Essentially what trial deletion is, you start with some object that you think might be the root of a bit of cyclic garbage. You trace around that cycle, deleting the effect on the reference count of any pointers that you encounter. If at the end of that stage every object has a reference count of zero, then that whole structure is garbage and can be reclaimed. The results of this is they get a collector that has throughput that's comparable to a parallel Mark Sweep collector, and they get, here's the important point, they get very good maximum pause time. Now this is a paper that's a few years old, and they claim a maximum pause time of just under 3 milliseconds. I'm sure it'll be faster or more than halfway. So that's the first point, they get good pause time. The second point, these pauses are well spread out. The last thing you want is lots of pauses all closely packed together, because that's as bad as a long pause. So that's one way of tackling reference counting. Here's another one. It's called sliding views. Now, consider this data structure. And suppose I start doing some operations on it. I move a pointer and then maybe move it again. For the object at the bottom right, its reference count is the same as it was when I started. It's kind of a waste of time to increment it and then decrement it. So what lots of people trying to do, they try to do that, optimize those increments and decrements by hand. The problem with that kind of optimization is as soon as you get it wrong in one place, you're killed.
10 minutes.
Okay. So the sliding view says, well, hey, I'll only remember what the state of the point that well, that pointer was pointing to at the beginning and what it was at the end. And by doing that, I don't have to remember all these intermediate operations on it. And we can do that by just remembering what it was that we start, and putting that into a buffer, and then passing that buffer to a local collector, which can then process that buffer so it knows what the state of the object was to begin with. It can look at its current state to see what it's pointing to at the end, and so on. A major challenge for garbage collectors, or garbage collector implementers for a long time, has been how to do real-time garbage collection. Is it possible? Now, some people would advocate region-based schemes, but many people believe that they're hard to program, they would need you to rewrite your libraries, and so on. The issues for the real-time garbage collection are, first of all, can you guarantee your worst-case pause times? And secondly, can you guarantee that the collector has gets a minimum share of the processor in any time window? The metronome collector is a collector for real-time systems. It really does guarantee those two properties. To explain very briefly how it handles this, it does allocation with segregated free lists with lots of different size classes. So here you maybe have a class, a list for objects of 4 bytes of list for objects of 8 bytes and so on. It does on mostly non-copying collection using a snapshot of the beginning algorithm to avoid retracing. Sometimes it has to do defragmentation, as any real system has, and it tries to avoid that as long as it can, but if it has to, then it moves objects, but it places a forwarding pointer in the head of each object. And so the user program, when it wants to get at an object, always has to do a dereference through that forwarding pointer, always. Now again, this is another piece of technology that you've probably seen for a long time. Now, does it work? Well, here are a couple of graphs showing metronome's performance. The two issues for real-time collection, how do you deal with, how do you schedule work? Do you schedule it by saying, let the garbage collector do a certain amount of work before you swap it out? Or do we say, let it work for a particular amount of time? And it turns out that time-based scheduling is much better than work-based scheduling. And if you look at the top graph, it shows that the metronome system always gives the user program about, for the particular parameters that they've selected, about 44% of the processor, guaranteed, always. But you have to specify two things. You have to specify the maximum amount of live memory in your system and the maximum allocation rate of your system. If you can't do those, you can't schedule a metronome. Another aspect I think is really quite interesting is looking at how we can better integrate the collector with its environment, rather than just seeing the collector as a system component that sits on its own isolated from everything else. So, example is to say, how can we integrate the collector better with the virtual memory manager to reduce paging? Now, one way is just for the collector to listen to what the virtual memory manager is doing and decide whether to expand the heap or do a collection based on the number of page faults that it's getting. If it's not getting any page faults, let's grow the heap. If it's getting page faults, let's do a collection and see if we can track the heap a bit. A much more interesting system is Emery Berger's bookmarking GC. This really does cooperate with the virtual memory manager, because whenever the virtual memory manager wants to evict a page, it notifies the collector that it's going to evict the page. And the collector is then allowed to make a suggestion to the VMM of to which page to evict. So if you imagine a semi-space copying collector, an obvious page to evict is one of the ones in the from space that you're not using. If that's not possible, then the bookmarking collector scans the page that it's going to have evicted for pointers going out of it and remembers those as bookmarks. It then protects the page and tells the virtual memory manager that it can be evicted. GC happens as normal, except that we don't follow pointers into evicted pages, but we do use those bookmarks as routes. When the page is eventually returned to main memory, we can trap access violations, so that's why we locked it, and we can remove the bookmarks for that page and remember that it is back in memory. So what sort of performance do we get? Well, you have to look at this graph, and it's kind of strange, because large value, small value. This graph is showing the average pause time as we make memory tighter and tighter and tighter. And it's showing a number of collection algorithms. And the only one you really want to look at is the one I've marked with a large purple arrow, which is down there. That's the bookmarking collector. All the others are paging wildly, and hence giving you awful performance. So, just starting to sum up. What can we do today? First of all, we can write garbage collectors that really do have performance that are competitive with explicit allocation and deallocation, and that certainly are not intrusive. We know how to do high-performance server GC for heaps of several gigabytes. Do we know how to do them for heaps of hundreds of gigabytes, which we'll see in the future? I'm not so sure. We can handle multiprocessor systems for when we've got, 16 processors. But if you look recently, Intel have announced a new chip that has 80 processors per chip. Can we scale collection up to these massively multiprocessor systems that I expect to see in the future? I'm not so sure. We can do real-time collection, providing you specify the parameters. Reference counting is a system that's worth considering, yeah, it really is. And we're starting to look at how we can integrate the collector with the operating system, for example, by cooperating over paging. Now, what's going to happen in the future? First of all, these kind of server systems are going to move to the desktops as our desktop machines become more and more multi-core. We need to be able to deal with that. I've showed you one way that the garbage collector and the virtual memory system, or the operating system, the environment generally can cooperate. But there are other ways. For instance, what about power-aware collection? If we've got a small device, can we save energy by turning off parts of the memory that we know we're not going to use? There is work starting to come in there, but I think that's another interesting area. The other way that I'm particularly interested in is trying to exploit knowledge of programs. Now, if you measure programs and look at how they allocate objects and how long those objects live, there are absolutely clear patterns, very distinctive patterns. And at the moment, we don't really exploit those. Okay, we say there are some objects that maybe the compiler knows about that it can, probably because they belong to some part of the operator, the runtime system, that we can say those will live forever. We never need to deallocate those. We never need to garbage collect those. We can do generational collection, which exploits the idea that most objects die young, but it doesn't deal with sort of the more troublesome middle-aged kind of objects. So I'm very interested in seeing how we can start to exploit these particular patterns of object lifetimes, how we can use static analyses maybe. Maybe not to say you can definitely reclaim this object now, which is the sort of thing that people try to do, I guess, in the early 90s, and without, I think, a great deal of success, although we have much better static analyses now. But to give hints to the garbage collector, to say things like, these objects reference each other and they live together, might be a good idea to co-allocate them in the same region. And to do that kind of advice to the collector. And finally, I've talked about today and the future. Let's not forget the past. I'm not trying to suck up to you, but the Lisp community has made a huge contribution to this field in the past. I looked back through some recent work, and I didn't see much on memory management implementation recently, not only at this conference, but in many others. But I know that many of you are doing it. I'd like to see that kind of stuff published. We learned lots of lessons with things like the Symbolics and other Lisp machines. Let's make sure those lessons aren't forgotten. I mean, I can see companies like Azure Systems who are reinventing many of the ideas that were in those systems. I mean, you might also say maybe they're also reinventing the business model of Symbolics. that's a big question. But you just, finally, I say you've done lots of good work. Why not publish it?
I talked to Jim Goodman, who invented cache coherence, and he says lock-free data structures might not be so important anymore in a couple of years because of a technique called speculative lock collision. So it's just a general question. Have you considered this kind of technique and what impact it could have if we suddenly have the right to do massive locking essentially for free?
Right. Well, first of all, it's not clear to me how massive your locking for free can be. Maybe he's right. But rather than having to worry about cache coherence, if I can do these systems, it just doesn't become a problem. It's not an issue, apart from in a few cases. So I'm trying to reduce the number of cases in which you do have to deal with locking or cache cohesion. Surely that's a good thing. Now, the other interesting thing about cache cohesion is, suppose I've got some kind of multi-core system and I'm running my user program on some cores and I'm running my collector on some other cores. One of the things about collectors, they tend to trample all over the cache. Is my concurrent collector, if you like, spoiling the cache for my user program? And what can I do about that? I think that's another issue that needs to be looked at. And I suspect the answer will be very architecture dependent. There's lots of difference between the AMD architecture and the Intel multi-core architectures, for example.
Somewhere over here.
So you talked about reference counting, tracing suspect cycles to see if they're really our cycles, but how do you find them in the first place? How do you find your suspected cycle?
Typically you store up all the objects that have had reference count decrements done on them. And your garbage cycles will be a subset of that set. So we're working in this epoch system, so that at the end of each epoch, you've got this list of decrements to do, those are your targets. Now you either do them immediately or you just store it up for a while and do it at some point. Yeah.
In the snapshot approach, do you have to stop the world to do the snapshot?
You only have to stop the world while you scan the roots of threads. So you do it once at the beginning, but you have to do that for incremental update as well. And there are on-the-fly algorithms, which mean you don't have to stop all the threads at the same time, but you can stop them one at a time to scan their roots. So, you know, stacks, registers, global variables, that sort of thing.
You started off by saying 5 years ago a lot of people regarded garbage collections as irrelevant and for weak minds and so on, and that's changed now. You mentioned this Azul Systems, who are building specialist hardware, is now, well, probably too late. I've been asking this question for a while. Should the garbage collection memory management experts be saying to people developing hardware, can you put an extra bit in that word, you know, while you've got the box open, what changes are there that we should be making to hardware to support the fact that it's all going to be running garbage collectors in a few years' time?
Right. I mean, first of all, I think that you're right that running systems with automatic memory managers is going to be prevalent. Now, there was a hiccup with Windows Vista, because at one time Vista was committed to run entirely on managed code, and then Microsoft backed out of it. I think you're absolutely right that this is an opportunity. The other workplace that it's an opportunity, and it's something that I'd be really interested in talking to if anyone who's working in this area here, is looking at cooperation between people in the virtual machine, brackets, programming language runtime community, and the virtual machine, brackets, operating systems community. Because that seems to me to be a particularly good way for us to talk together. Now, as for what we should put in, I think there are lots of examples in the Azul system. We would like very fast memory protection fault traps. The fact that you've got a memory protection fault doesn't mean your program is broken and going to die, and so, you know, it doesn't matter how long it takes to handle a fault. We'd like them to be fast. Maybe we're interested in things like, the other thing is, they have tag pointers, because they have a not marked through bit in each pointer, so that they can tell if the collector has been down that path before or not, and so on. And there are other ideas.
I think maybe one more. We didn't have very little time.
You mentioned program knowledge as a point for the future of garbage collection.
Yeah.
In the field of operating systems, there are already paging algorithms, for instance, that use this kind of knowledge, like working set algorithms. So I'm a bit surprised that you consider this idea of program knowledge futuristic. I mean,
okay.
Isn't there anybody working on
that? The examples you give are not working on program knowledge of a particular program. They're working on observed behavior. So in a sense that they're dealing, taking action after the event. What I would like to do, what we started to do with a system based on our Beltway collector. Our Beltway collector is a collector that has multiple places that you can allocate. And the idea here is that if you know that objects are going to live very briefly, you allocate them on this belt. The metaphor is of a conveyor belt. If you know that objects are going to live for a long time, you allocate them somewhere where they won't even be touched for a long time. So it's not a case of you do something and then you observe that that was probably not a good idea to do, which I think is what you're suggesting. But you're saying, I know from my analysis of the program, it's probably a good idea just to leave these things for a long time, not to allocate them in the young generation, then promote them to the old generation and so on, but just put them somewhere where we won't look at for a long time.
Okay, thank you.